Hello, this is Yuvocal.
Howdy, this is Sid Lowe.
Welcome to Big Lens Fast Shutter, where we demystify the world of sports photography.
Here at News, both Ryu and I will tell you our best and worst shoot of the previous month, and we talk about ourselves because we like to. So, Ryu, what was your best and worst shoot this month?
The best was 3 matches in Spain where I was told by a Japanese magazine to shoot Jose Mourinho and Pep Guardiola. And to have to shoot a manager throughout a match is a lot more difficult than you can possibly imagine because they don't really do that much compared to, you know, field players. They just kind of go up and down the sidelines. In case of Jose Mourinho, the second time I shot him, he only came out of the bench maybe 3 times during the match. So you kind of have to be on your toes all the time, and you also have to kind of think about like what kind of composition you can actually use in terms of actually shooting people like that. You tend to get stuck in one composition. And in my case, I use a D3 and 4 and a 2.8, and I need to use a teleconverter to get up close as much as possible. And also, I didn't sit next to the goal like I do when I'm shooting normal football. I went up the sideline as much as I can go until security told me I can't go anymore. And I had to pop my head out as far as possible and get a glimpse of Guardiola or Mourinho doing their thing. The worst shoot was probably the EuroLeague Final Four. It wasn't a very bad shoot per se, but I wrote on my blog post last week that photographers, they were cheering on their team. I don't want to really get into it, but just find it quite annoying. The professionals, it's okay to cheer on a little bit here and there, but we're actually there to take pictures of the event, and we're not there to be fans. That, I just find it really, really annoying. Well, that was it. Yeah, Sid, how was yours then?
Oh, I had a pretty lean month. I really only shot one event. It was an Asian Champions League qualifying round match. It was the last match for one of the most recognised Australian players that plays for the team called Melbourne Victory. And he...
What's his name?
He's the captain. My God. His name escapes me.
Mike Viduka. No, it's not.
No, not Mike Viduka. Why did you ask me his name? It is Kevin Muscat. It was Kevin's last match. Anyway, he was trying to get a couple of shots of Kevin that hopefully would have got a cover for the weekly newspaper that I shoot for. Interestingly, it was a shot of him and the coach or manager just shaking hands before the start of the match, and that made cover. So it was a good shot. It was a good shoot. Apart from that, though, it was a pretty lackluster match, so not too much happened. But as most of these things, you get a good shot that is what the editor or publisher wants. And that's probably as good as you can get. So pretty lean month. And next month is pretty lean too. I think there's a couple of rugby matches and maybe an international. But yeah, getting into winter, it's pretty slow down here now. If you don't shoot Australian rules football.
You're right. It's the opposite. We're going to summer and then you're going into winter. Bad match this month?
No, I only had one shoot, really, and I was still coming back from the US, so not much happening.
Okay, let's hope that, you know, something interesting will happen in June. And, well, that's it from us. From us.
Reintroduce is a section where we present a sports photographer or a person related to the sports photography business. And who do we have this month? Sid.
Hi, Ryu. This month, we've got Michael Brown from a company called PhotoWorks. Mike is an Australian. He lives in the same city as me, and we're really privileged to have Mike talk to us this month.
Hi, Sid. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
For you.
So, Mike, let's get this started. How did you get into photography?
I suppose my first interest in photography when I was in primary school, one of the teachers was involved in photography and he had a little dark room at the school and dragged me in there, and I thought it was pretty cool. Sort of hopped out of it for a while because photography equipment was quite expensive back then, and I bought my first camera when I was 14, I think. Started snapping a few shots around the place, but back in the bad old days of film. And I suppose professionally I didn't really get back into it until I was 19, where I was doing a bit of event work shooting with a Nikon F3, which was a bit of fun.
You were one of these guys that goes to restaurants and shoot people having dinner and then sell them photos, right?
Yes, thanks for reminding me about that, Sid. That was great. I did do that for about a year, and I must say I felt very dirty. It actually was good because it helped me master using Flash, because you obviously have to use Flash at those type of events. And then after a while, I had enough of seeing the same people at the same venues all the time, and I ended up asking the owner of the company if I could run the lab. So I ended up running the people that were doing all of the printing, which was another good experience for me. It was an interesting time in my life that I didn't have much of a social life as a 19-year-old.
How did you move from shooting people in restaurants and selling them photos to sports photography?
Well, there was a period in between where I mostly did weddings. I really cut my teeth on weddings and personal photography, and I did that for quite a while, mostly with film. Got out of photography for about 3 years completely, had a break, and then wanted to get back in. And there was an advertisement for a company that does a lot of junior sports and club sports, looking for photographers. And I went along there and basically started from there.
Now, you and I first met when you were the company that was contracted to cover all the images for the Homeless World Cup when it was held in Melbourne, Australia.
At the time, PhotoWorks was in its infancy. It had only been going for about 6 months. And my partner at the time and I were doing mostly pro sport, world superbikes and a lot of that sort of stuff, and Moomba Masters and AFL. We stuck our toe into doing junior sports when we thought we'll give this, the grand finals, a try for the Australian rules football here in one area. And we tried it out for one day. And we got a lot of very positive feedback from parents and basically people ringing up saying, yeah, please come out and take photos of our children. Nobody does that here. It really started the ball rolling and actually moved the transition away from pro sport to club level and junior sport was fairly immediate, because the commercial realisation here in Australia is extremely difficult as a professional sort of pro level sports photographer shooting pro sports. It's very saturated. There's a lot of people wanting to get in. It was quite glamorous, obviously. There just isn't a lot of money in it if that's all you're going to do. So we had to move across. You know, the commercial realization, I think, to us was quite amazing. But yeah, the Homeless World Cup was a very interesting event. And really how that came about was when I formed PhotoWorks over 3 years ago, one of the charters for the company is we pick a charity each year and we will support that charity. And that particular year, we picked the magazine called The Big Issue. We found out that they were hosting the Homeless World Cup here in 2008. And I said, oh, look, we'll give that a go. It was a big eye opener for me because it was a massive event. It ran over a week. The pre-events before the actual week were huge. I was running around for probably a good month, athletes coming in and so forth. If I remember rightly, Sid, I probably only got to shoot on the last day myself at the actual grand final, but the rest of the week I was pretty much an image editor and media distributor.
How can you remember how many photographers you organised for the Homeless World Cup and over how many days?
We had 13 photographers over those 5 days. And kudos to all of them, including yourself, Sid, that came along and gave up their time. As I said, it was a volunteer thing because it was a charitable thing. And from PhotoWorks' perspective, it was great for exposure. You know, we got published and our photographers got published all over the world. But for me, as director of the company, it basically said, okay, we can handle these large events. We got through it. We survived. We can do these large events. And since then, we've done World Karate Championships, you know, with 1,600 competitors and covered all of them. And as you know, we did Australian Volleyball Championship Schools Cup in December, which was 4,500 competitors. And we covered all of their games. So we now have the confidence that we can go in and cover these types of events.
I think the scale of what you did for Homeless World Cup was certainly, as an agency, as big an effort as, for example, Getty Images at the Australian Open. Ryu, you know the Homeless World Cup is in Paris in about a month's time. You know, they'd be looking for sports photographers, and I reckon you should go and check it out and maybe volunteer and help.
I have to work on my off-season as well?
Yeah, it's not work. It's
great fun.
It's putting back.
Putting back, I put a lot back. I put my back into my work. I put my soul at tears.
Yeah. In fact, love. I think I might volunteer you for it.
Sid, aren't you over in Europe around that same time?
Unfortunately, I'm not there yet. I would have gone a little bit earlier. But you can't be your off-season, really. There's the Women's World Cup that's going to be in Germany. You've got to be shooting that.
It's a Women's World Cup. No one watches them, you know?
Oh, Australia's going to win.
Either going to be Japan or Germany, and that's it. But I know Germany's going to win. It's going to be three in a row.
Australia's playing Japan in the first round.
We'll beat them.
Australia is the Asian champions. They beat Japan.
Well, we lost to what? We lost to Germany? No, we lost to America in the gold medal round.
Oh, no, Olympics don't round. No, it's the World Cup. Back to Mike. Oh, that's great. Okay, off you go.
I've only ever shot professional sports, and I would like to know what kind of transition you had to make kind of personally and also as a business going from professional into almost mostly just shooting non-professional or like amateur sports.
It wasn't just the business side that was a big transition. Now, no longer were we marketing ourselves to magazines, hoping to license an image. And obviously with the amateur sport, we don't have to caption after each game and so forth. It becomes a lot more about volume rather than those half a dozen great shots. If an average Australian rules football game here for a junior team would run for about or nearly 2 hours, and we expect something like between 350 and 500 shots of all of the different competitors to be loaded onto our website, which we then market to the parents. We have to have that sort of volume. Before, we'd shoot an AFL game and we'd go through and pick our best 10 photos and submit those to the wires or to the magazines or the papers. So it is a very different way of thinking. And I must say, the guys that I use also shoot for the papers and they shoot for the wire services and so forth. So they also have to switch their way of thinking as well. And the crew that I've got are exceptionally good at doing that. So I'm really happy with the guys that I've got to do it. From a business perspective, it's a lot more going out and pressing the flesh, being seen at the local clubs, becoming basically a known person around the clubs. We do a lot of sponsoring of the actual clubs because at that level they need it. So we put a lot back into the actual sporting clubs that we shoot for. Yeah, it's a very different way of thinking. And PhotoWorks also, we've had to diversify a little bit, and we do contract out to other companies as well doing similar things. We do a lot of image editing. Our in-house editing is quite good here. We do a lot of team photos and so forth, and that's probably the bread and butter.
The other thing I wanted to know, and I think a lot of people who are listening might be interested, is there like a way that you can actually then make money out of amateur sports from the get-go, or you think you'd actually need to, you know, form a company like you did in order to actually make money out of it?
I think if you're not doing it on a larger scale like we are, it's going to be chump change, really. If I went and did a football game on a particular day of, say, the under-12s, we'd be lucky if we got a couple of $100 out of it. You have to do it on a larger scale to make it viable. My suggestion, I suppose, to the amateurs that are wanting to break into sports photography, I will say this from the get-go, and I've said this to a few photographers that now shoot for me and other guys that have looked at getting into it. If you're looking at just getting into sports photography in Australia, unless you're doing something like what PhotoWorks is doing as a company, or you get a job in the wires or the papers, it's an extremely tough way to make a living. It's a very small market here. If you were Joe Blow, you walk into the local football club and you start taking photos and hope to make some money, you won't be making a lot. As said, I've got about 15 photographers on my books now that I can access. We do pay reasonably well, don't we, Sid? And look, it's... I would suggest, and I must say, I've had a few guys go through our company and now work for the papers, and they've made a career of it. It's a great way to cut your teeth in sports photography. Look, I'm always quite open for amateurs to come along and basically park themselves with us and learn. And we are actually looking at running some courses probably later this year as a suggestion from a good friend of mine, possibly just sports photography for parents or maybe some amateurs coming in and how to get the best out of your photos. I would suggest if you're just getting into it, your club level sports and your junior sports are the way to start. Hone your skill first. Hone your skill before you even approach some of these bigger guys and try and get into shooting pro sports. And believe it or not, junior sports can be actually more difficult to shoot than the pro stuff.
Do you have to kind of be like cut out to be like shooting amateur sports? I just don't think I can actually do it because I've now done professional and then we have to shoot kids and Sunday league and things like that. Do you think there's a big difference between the two?
I think it really depends on the sport. No offense to the football or soccer crowd. I think the juniors there, it's probably poles apart from the seniors or the pro stuff. You can see the skill level is a lot different. Where, say, Australian rules football, I always look at it as just a mini version. As I said, it's a lot more challenging with kids, for example. If I go and shoot AFL at the pro level, at the highest level, I can pretty much know that player A, if he's coming down that part of the field, he's going to kick the ball and it's going to go to player B, and I'll be spun around on player B ready for the mark. So I already know where it's going. I know the plays. With the juniors, you just don't know where it's going to go. So you've really got to be on the ball to try and track it. It definitely, in some sports, probably not as exciting to shoot at an amateur level, but you will still improve your skills as an emerging amateur or semi-pro by shooting the amateur stuff. I must say, the Melbourne, where Sid and I live, is an extremely sports-centric city. And I think, especially with our main sport here, which is the AFL or Australian Football League, they're so passionate in Melbourne, and I'm talking about the whole city, is so passionate about that sport. It doesn't matter whether it's under nines or AFL, you'll still get the crowd standing there cheering and screaming exactly the same way.
If you go to American schools or American-based schools, school sports are very, very big, high school, university level. But in Europe, there's none, and people don't really go and watch them. Your kid's 9, 10, you have a little club sports and parents will come and cheer, but after a certain age, they usually don't. If you are planning to do something in Europe as a sports photographer, I don't think there's that many amateur events that's really economically viable. That's kind of what I thought about it.
We're pretty lucky here, as I said, with the way sports is structured. Whilst we've got colleges and they do have sport, it's not treated the same as the US. We have sporting clubs rather than it all being based around a university or a college. So it is a very different mentality here. The other issue is we're not having to approach schools, we're approaching clubs. It's a different way of thinking, yeah, especially when you take the government out of it. It's a lot easier, I suppose.
While we're talking about, I suppose, shooting for clubs and so forth, can you tell our listeners a little bit about what kind of photos do the parents buy? What do you have to shoot on the weekend if you want to sell some prints?
That's actually a very interesting question, Sid, because I was listening to your last podcast and you mentioned about an image with two competitors is a lot more exciting, I suppose, than one competitor. And that is definitely correct in pro sport. However, in junior and amateur sport, it actually comes back to the individual. So the photos that sell more are the ones of the player out on their own with a beautiful clean background, about to kick the ball or kicking through the ball. So the players on their own are the ones that sell the most. I thought it was quite interesting when I listened to that podcast. That is one of the differences between pro and amateur, because pro's about the game and the moment and the action, where amateur's about the player.
Is that right? I hadn't even thought about it that way, but I suppose you're right. You know, the parents or the player wants a photo of themselves, and presumably if they're actually doing a good tackle on somebody, you know, and they might want that one, but I could definitely see that they want something by themselves, yeah.
You'd be amazed how many parents or mums will ring up saying, look, you've got a fantastic photo of my son and he's kicking the ball, but that other player in the background, can you get rid of him out of there? And one of the luxuries that we have in selling prints to parents and clubs is we don't have the ethical restrictions of the journalism world. Obviously, if the photos are going into the papers, then we're not going to do that. But for mum, of course, we can do that sort of stuff and we do it.
And charge them.
Oh, of course we do. Yes, absolutely. It's about the individual. It's about that player. And it's about the person who wants to buy that photo of their player.
What about the group shots?
I suppose there's two types of group shots. Every club gets photographers in to do their team photos each year. It's like a record for the club. The parents buy those. And I suppose over a whole season, that would be the mainstream of income. The action stuff, we only do the main events. We've got the intra-league stuff coming up, the mid-year one league versus the other league stuff coming up in the next month. But the end of the season, grand finals, that's where we make our action money. Individual and group photos, or I think they call them team and individual photos over in the UK and the US. That's where our mainstream income comes throughout the season. In the grand finals, definitely that winning jube celebration group shot at the end, we sell a lot of those.
Interesting.
And Mike, how much do they usually go for? Because I've seen in a couple, you know, Flickr sports photographer groups, and I've been asked by a bunch of parents to shoot this event. I don't know what to price per picture. A lot of people have different opinions of it. But what do you think is like a good kind of measuring stick of how much you can actually, I guess, as much as you want to, but
this actually came up as a fairly good debate between myself and my former partner who opened the business with me. When we first started out, we basically had to work out, okay, what product are we going to sell at what price points? And really comes down to the market that you're looking at now. The market that we are mainly in, obviously a lot of the listeners won't know this, but the northwest area of Melbourne, it'd be a middle income type area, middle to low. It's not an extremely rich area. My previous partner basically said, well, look, let's start out at an 8x12 as the smallest print that we sell. And I said, no, let's not do that. Let's go down even further. And we actually start out at a 5x7 print. our lowest price is $12. And the reason we started out that, it doesn't sound like a lot of money, but the reason we started there is because there's a lot of single mums that have got their young bloke playing footy and they just want a keepsake. They want a bit of a memory of their kid playing, and they're not rich people. And we've started doing that, and we actually found that we had an edge over our competitors because they were allowing us to come in because people were going, fantastic, we can afford that. Now, our prices do go up to as high as $350 for a fully framed collage and all that sort of stuff, but we wanted to start at that lower price point.
$350.
So, framed collage, a bit of memorabilia. Our catchphrase when we first started this company is we want to bring pro sports photography to junior and amateur sports, right? So we want to be shooting little Johnny exactly the same as we'd be shooting Brendan Favola or one of the pro AFL players or Archie. Sorry, Sid, you'll have to help me with the name.
Roach.
Yes, thank you. Over in the...
No, he's a singer.
Oh, thank you very much for that. We wanted to bring the same skill level and style of photography to the juniors. And we've also brought the same type of thing to our, I suppose, memorabilia and collages and so forth. The stuff that you can go and pay $2,000 for, a bit of signed memorabilia. We can do exactly the same for a young bloke playing footy. And the parents love that. And believe it or not, we move a few of them. So,
because I think alongside wedding, parents will pay through their nose for their kids.
That's why we do weddings too. Let me just say that the sports season in Melbourne would probably run for 5 to 6 months with the football and the overlap of soccer. And then the rest of the year, we're looking at other things. We have to diversify the business. So we do weddings. We do commercial work. So
give our listeners a little sense of when you shot the World Karate Championships, for example. What kind of equipment do you put on site where all the action is happening, and how do you organize the selling of the prints and all that kind of stuff?
We run it two different ways. For an event like that, we had an on-site viewing station. So we had 10 viewing stations lined up so that people could come along and look at their photos.
So what's a viewing station?
It's basically a computer. We had 10 computers lined up, all hooked up into a server where photos were constantly coming in from the photographers. I had basically an editor sitting there sorting the photos and putting them out to the viewing station so people could look through their events. For that type of event, it was broken down into time frames, so each half an hour blocks. So if you were on ring number one, for example, and you were there between 11 and 11:30, you go into the viewing station and you find that area, and then you'll find your photos. And it was quite quick for them to get to their photos. We did have on-site printing there. We had a die sub printer there as well. For that type of event with that sort of volume, it's probably not that viable. What we ended up doing was the people that bought the larger products, the collages and frame prints, we'd actually throw in a die sub 8x12 print to take away with them, because obviously with that sort of product, we can't do it on site with a collage. So we'd give them something to take away so they feel like they weren't just handing over their money. So we had the 10 viewing stations. I think we had 4 sales staff at the time and one guy doing the editing and uploading, myself overviewing, and 6 photographers working the event. Now, I think there was 1,600 competitors at that event. Over 2 days.
Every competitor would have had photos from how many bouts?
At least one. Some people, we got them 3 or 4 times in different bouts. We tried to get them at least once, and we did achieve that for the karate. We got everybody. Another event that we did just before Christmas, which was 4,500 competitors over 5 days, I think we missed 3 teams, but that was due to last-minute changes in schedule. Now, there was 450 teams.
I just want to know, how do the parents know how to find a photo of their kids?
If we're at the event, obviously they've got the viewing stations and we do a lot of marketing at the event. They can then come to the website after. Now, every event that we do, even if we're doing on-site, the images will go up online as well, so they can access the images online. The events where it comes to kids under a certain age, they need an access code to get into those events. We sort them in a way that's logical so that it would be easy for a punter. You have to break away from being a photographer when you're doing this sort of thing, because you have to think like the parent would think. I need to find my photo of my child. I need to do it quickly, because you do lose interest pretty quickly on the web. The system that we've got, our online commerce system is extremely good and extremely efficient, and they don't seem to have any problems finding them, except for when they ring me the day after and say, why aren't the photos online yet? 35,000 images, it's going to take me a little time to get them up. And thinking about that for a moment, the Homeless World Cup, I think we had 40,000 images in a period of 5 days. The Volleyball Australia, the Schools Cup that we did in December, there was 35,000 images. All of those have to be sorted into teams or matches, events, locations, and then uploaded onto the website. I think volleyball we had up within 3 days. We've got a pretty good system. We use the Apple Aperture for our main image library. It's got some very good editing stuff in it, but I mainly use it for the library management. It links into our website very well. Basically, we can upload directly from the application into our website once it's all sorted.
You're basically doing what Sports Illustrated do at, say, the Super Bowl, where you've got all the shooters coming in, giving you the cards, you're uploading, but you've got the pressure that when the person finishes their event, they can come to the viewing stations, see the photos almost in straight away, and then decide to buy the picture. Have I got that right?
Yes, with the karate, because of the venue was extremely dark, we asked the photographers to shoot in RAW initially. We had to stop after about 3 hours when we had a massive backlog of images. It was taking too long to get up. So we switched them to JPEG. And look, fortunately, the photographers we had were very good. With the volleyball event, the images were up ready to view within 30 minutes of the match. And bear in mind, how many courts did we have going? I think there was 14 courts going. It was quite amazing. We do small events as well. We shoot for Orienteering Victorious. We do all the orienteering events, which is good fun. A lot of listeners will think of orienteering as those people walking around the city with a map and a compass. Now, these guys are full on. They sprint through the bush and they come out all torn up with blood running down their legs, and it's quite amazing. And they combine it now with mountain biking as well, which makes it a little bit more fun as well. So we do small events as well, not just the big ones.
But I think just the fact that you've basically got to turn up with a rack full of computers, printers, salespeople, that's a dimension of, I think, sports photography that's probably quite different to shooting professional sports.
Definitely. And that's one of the big differences. One of the other big differences with an event like the volleyball or Total Girls Soccer, that was a very interesting tournament over 2 days. There was 1,600 players we had to cover every game. Each of those events, there's usually between 3 and 4 days of planning before the event to make sure that we cover everybody. So we have to sit there with the schedules and make sure that we jiggle around the shooters. Where are we going to put them? There's a lot of planning goes in to make sure that we cover these events. And that's probably the number one difference with what we do compared to some of our competitors is we can guarantee that we cover everybody or cover every team at least, only because of the planning that we put in beforehand.
Mike, is there anything you want to plug in terms of your website where people can find you and things like that?
It's www.photoworks.com.au. We're also on Facebook as well, so PhotoWorks has a page. So come along and like us if you like. Thank you, guys. It was good fun. It was a great opportunity to come in and have a chat to you. And I look forward to listening to the rest of your podcasts.
Thanks, Mike. No, it's been great. In Masterclass, we pick a topic in sports photography and we discuss it with our interviewee. So this month, Ryu, our topic's going to be workflow. And workflow is a huge topic, but we're just going to concentrate this month on what kind of software is out there and what we use and why we use it to manage all our photos for the jobs that we do.
Right, and we have to apologize in advance because we didn't come up with the masterclass topic before we interviewed Mike and we introduced, and therefore it's going to be just me and Sid, and we'll make sure that this will never happen again. It's all Sid's fault, but
yes, that's very true.
It just kind of happens this way.
So Ryu, in masterclass this month, topic being workflow, I just wanted to break down what I think most photographers would mean by workflow. Then we can talk about specifically what tools we use to do that. Workflow is typically in three parts. We do something called ingesting, and ingesting is when we take the photos that's on our memory cards or on the camera and stick it on a computer. Once the image is ingested, we do some image editing. So that could be cropping, color correction, all that stuff. And then the third step is exporting out the images to wherever they need to go. And for working sports photographers, it's usually being sent to the publisher, the agency, or even just exported out onto a DVD that you might want to give to the client. So in those three steps, there are lots of software that we can choose. I'll hand it over to you and you can tell our listeners what software you use and, you know, why you use it.
I use Photo Mechanic, and the reason I use it is because I've been recommended by other sports photographers who use it. As you may know, quite a lot of sports photographers do use Photo Mechanic because it's just a very simple way to sort out your photos and send them or upload them as you may. And in my case, as Sid said, you ingest or upload the photos onto your computers. I then start color coding them. And once I've color coded them, I will see all the ones that I've color coded, the one I want to send immediately. I'll pick one photo and then I will compress it to under 1 megabyte. So at this moment, there's no cropping, there's no editing because my agency doesn't really want that. But these things really depend on what kind of agency you work for, what kind of client you work for. There are variations for this. But in my case, I compress it to under 1 megabyte and then I will send an email. And inside the email, instead of actually putting caption in the metadata, I would put the place, time, whether it happened the first half or the second half, who they were playing, who's actually in the frame, and what they're doing. That in a sentence, like you normally write an email. And then I send it off. And I usually send per match between 5 to 10 photos, and that's it. Sid will probably explain to you how his workflow is, and I'm sure that his is a lot longer than mine because that's probably the more correct way of doing workflow stuff on sports photography.
Cool. So you mentioned you color code your raw images as they're coming in. How many colors do you use?
I use usually two. Well, I use pink to get the ones that I want, and then I use red for the ones that I've sent. But when it gets a bit more complicated, for instance, if I've got two clients that want images from the same match, then I use three. So I do pink to do the overall, all the good ones, and red for the one client, and then yellow for the other client. So I know which one's sent to where.
So this is probably a question that a lot of our listeners want to know. The ones that don't get color-coded at all, do you delete them straight away and never clog up your hard disk ever again?
They're gone.
They're gone.
I might have actually had a conversation about this on podcast that I just don't really see that much of a point in keeping photos that I'm never going to see ever again.
That's right.
And you know what I mean? Like, what are you going to do with it?
All right. So here are some other software to use. And we'll post a link on our blog about all of the things we're going to talk about. Granddaddy of all workflow software combination is usually the Adobe Bridge product and Adobe Photoshop. This combination has been there for however old Adobe Photoshop is, so 10, 15 odd years. It'd be fair to say that this combination has now been superseded in the Adobe world by a program called Adobe Lightroom. And there are many people that use Lightroom, not only sports photographers, but the landscape, portrait, studio, commercial, because it works really well. And Apple has got software that competes with Lightroom, and that's called Aperture. And both of these programs you have to buy. They're $100, $200, but it doesn't come for free. If you use an Apple Macintosh, you get something for free. It's called iPhoto, and you can certainly do workflow with iPhoto. And if you're on the Windows computer, there's a number of bits of software that we're aware of. It's Picasa 3. That's something that I think Google makes. It's free. Windows Live Photo Gallery comes with Windows operating system, I believe. And they're the two free options that you might have if you were using Windows. And Photo Mechanic is something that Ryu's already mentioned. And there's another one that used to be quite popular. It was called iView Media Pro. And that was also a really good program to allow you to manage all the photos that you've captured at certain shoots and doing the workflow. So each of these programs have their strengths and weaknesses, but the two that I think are the most common today are Aperture and Lightroom for the ones that people will spend money to buy. And iPhoto is free. And there's a huge difference between how iPhoto works and how Aperture and Lightroom works. And the best way to describe the difference is that Aperture and Lightroom use something that's called non-destructive editing. And what that means is that you can crop a photo, you can change some color balance or tweak the exposure in the photos, and it doesn't actually make changes to the original image file. It actually stores a sequence of instructions that the software says, oh, you want to increase the brightness or you want to increase the sharpening and stuff like that. And it just applies it to the image and shows you on the screen. The beauty of that is you can unwind all of your changes and give you back to the original photo, or you can effectively bake in the changes by exporting that image out with the changes that you like to have on it. The second part about the editing process is this whole thing called writing captions or adding metadata. And there's going to be a blog post from, by the time this podcast out, it'll be a couple of weeks back, is going to be all about how do you get metadata into the photos. That's what Aperture Lightroom and Photo Mechanic and all of the software allow you to do, is add metadata. And the metadata usually describes the photo and puts all the copyright bits and pieces on it, which is pretty important if you're submitting your photos. Now, the big difference between iPhoto and some of the other applications that do destructive editing is that because it changes the actual photo, iPhoto actually saves a duplicate copy of the original image with the changes every time you make a change. So if you are having very big image files, anything from a 10 or 12 megapixel camera these days, you know, each image is probably about 6 or 7 megabytes. As soon as you make one change on the photo, it'll save another copy of the photo and it'll be another 7 or 8 megabytes. So this is something that not many people are aware of if they're using these destructive photo editors, but all of a sudden they find they've got no space left on the hard drive. So be careful when you start using software to do image editing, because if the software saves duplicate copies, you're going to find it swallowing up your hard disk space pretty, pretty quickly.
And can you tell us briefly how your workflow is?
I use a combination of Lightroom and Photo Mechanic. I actually use Lightroom most. I will take my memory card. I will use the Finder to copy all of the photos that were on the memory card onto my hard disk. And then I add the photos into my Lightroom library. And at the same time, the first thing I do is I change the name of the file into something that's unique. So you might say, well, what does that mean? Well, because the camera will rename or just name the files in sequence, after 999 photos, it's going to go back to 0 or 1 again. So I could conceivably have the same file name 3, 4, 5 times on my hard disk. So the file name that comes off the camera isn't unique. Now, if I need to find a photo later on, you know, in months or years later, I actually need to have a unique file name so I can find the photos. So every time I import a card, the file name is actually rewritten or renamed so that it's timestamped. So it's got the date and it's got the time, and then it's got the original file name that came out of the camera. And then that means that it's a unique name and it only exists once on my hard drive. Once I've got all those photos in, I do exactly what Ryu's described before with his color scheme, but I actually use stars. I will quickly go through all of the files, and the ones that I want to look at again, I make 1 star, and then I look at just the 1 stars, and then I will select the ones that I want to submit and make them 2 stars. In the process of doing that, if I find something that I really, really like, and I might say, you know, I want to put this one in my personal portfolio as one of my nicer shots, I'll actually rename that to 3 stars. So Lightroom allows me just to show the 1 star, 2 stars, or 3 star photos really, really quickly. And then I will take those and I will either use Lightroom's captioning features to add the metadata. So the caption, the headline, and all the bits and pieces in my agency needs me to add inside Lightroom, and then I'll export them out using the JPEG export tools onto the disk, and then I will file those using an FTP software. Sometimes I use Photo Mechanic for captioning. One of the agencies I use actually has some pretty funky formats that only Photo Mechanic can write to. In that case, after I export the files, add the metadata in Photo Mechanic just before I upload to the FTP servers, and be done with it. And all of this literally happens within 15 minutes, 30 minutes after an event. And then, as Ryu saying, all the photos that I don't select just gets trashed. So pretty simple.
Yeah, and I just want to add in the end that in terms of that sorting viewing software that Sid listed, some agencies, like for instance Getty or big newspapers, have their proprietary software. So they develop their own software that makes it easier for the photographers out in the field and in events to be able to upload the photos very quickly. And I think in most cases they're Windows software.
Actually, I just wanted to also add one thing. Don't feel you have to go and buy Aperture or Lightroom or Photo Mechanic if you're just starting out doing sports photography. The free bits of software like iPhoto works incredibly well, especially the current versions. So if you've got a fairly decent bit of hardware, either in a laptop or in a desktop computer, iPhoto is perfectly fine for you to practice and start using the techniques of adding captions and uploading them maybe to Flickr or to your website. Just use the same process that we just described, and you'll find the software really works well. In fact, I was at the World Superbikes. I saw one of the photographers there was actually using iPhoto to manage all of the photos that he was shooting and sending back to the agency. So it's not necessary to get any of this fancy stuff. The only reason to do it is if you need the degree of control and the features of managing thousands and thousands of libraries, images in your library, that slows down, you know, software like iPhoto doesn't do that very well. Anyway, that's it.
You Win is part of the show where you, the listeners, participate in a monthly themed competition. The top three photos will be presented on our website, and the grand champion will be interviewed on the show.
This month's winner is Ekaterina Loktova from Moscow. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to contact Ekaterina via email, so there won't be an interview. Hopefully, we'll get her next month. Anyway, congratulations, Ekaterina, and to the second and third place getters as well, and you'll see their photos on our blog post.
To participate, go to our Flickr group, Big Lens Fast Shutter, and post your pictures on the June-themed competition topic, which is what?
Liquid. Any form of liquid. Water, sweat, blood, perspiration. Just have fun and post your photos in our Flickr group.
In Far Post, Near Post, we take questions from our listeners and try to answer them as eloquently as possible. And this month, we have John Dennis Batista from the Philippines. He wants to know, which one is better for sports photography, RAW or JPEG? Sid, which one?
Well, this is going to be a big can of worms because RAW versus JPEG is one of the most debated topics on the internet about photography. But I think it's a pretty simple question if we limit it to sports photography, because there are two main differences between RAW and JPEG. And if I just quickly explain to the listeners who may not be technically minded, the RAW file is basically what the camera sensor has recorded. So it's a very technical representation of what the camera has captured, and people say it's the digital negative if it was in the film world. The JPEG version is what the camera software has interpreted the RAW file, and with the settings that the person has wanted to tweak the photo, you can have these things like vibrance or sharpening or exposure compensation, and that stuff is applied to the RAW file and saved out to the memory card. Now, given those are the two differences, one of the main reasons that people want the RAW version is that the interpretation of the RAW file into the JPEG format is always improving. So the quality of the software that can look at a RAW file from 5 years ago to today has improved so much that if you captured a photo using RAW format 5 years ago, it's going to look better today. Now, that might be really compelling to shoot only RAW, but the trade-off is, have you got enough disk space and is your camera fast enough to actually shoot RAW for sports? So at a technical level, you've actually got to look at if your camera is able to shoot and capture enough frames in the buffer. If you've got a bit of action and you want to use the 5 frames per second or 9 frames per second and do a burst, some cameras can't record fast enough and you're going to miss the action. So at the very basic level, you got to look to see whether your camera is capable of shooting RAW. If it isn't, then you really don't have a choice. You've got to shoot JPEG. If your camera is able to shoot RAW, then you've got a big decision to make. Do I think I'm ever going to need to have the digital file because someone's going to ask me 5 years later, can I have a version of this image again and, you know, make it look good? And I think that if the answer is no, you're never going to be asked that, then you probably don't really need to shoot in RAW, and a high quality JPEG out of your camera is going to be pretty good. So that's my view about, at a very elementary level on, or at a very high level on, RAW versus JPEG. Personally, in shooting sports, I would generally shoot everything in JPEG. I've actually flip-flopped over the years where I've shot in JPEG, shot in RAW, gone back to JPEG. Having said that, if the lighting conditions are pretty challenging, so late afternoon sun, anything that's challenging, I might flip over and shoot in RAW, but by and large, I'll shoot everything in JPEG because it's so much faster to process smaller files using the workflow stuff that we talked about earlier. What about you, Ryu? What do you use?
I use JPEG most of the time, like you said, because I don't really see the point of RAW as much as other people see it in them. One thing I really don't like is the fact that it clogs up the buffer. And exactly like you said, if I'm doing a shot of a guy shooting the ball, and if I'm shooting in RAW, I'm shooting, I don't know, 6-7 frames, that might be it. And it will just stall, and I'll miss a shot. And I don't really like the fact that I have to develop the RAW later on. It takes a long time, and most magazines that I've worked for are fine with using JPEGs because of the fact that the software inside the camera has improved over the years, and you can actually produce very, very good JPEGs now compared to what it was 5 years ago. People might swear by using RAW in sports, and I know a lot of sports photographers who do use RAW in sports, but if you're asking me in terms of convenience and in terms of just the fact that it doesn't clog up my buffer, I'd really go with RAW. I mean, sorry, JPEG. But yeah, we might talk about it next week if there's more question about this RAW versus JPEG. But in most cases, it is kind of a matter of taste. It's a matter of how much time you have. There might actually be viewers out there who might say RAW is much better to shoot sports photos than JPEG for these reasons, blah, blah, blah. We'll be more than happy to hear from you.
I'll give you a good example of one sports photographer I've seen on the web that shoots everything in RAW, and his archive is worth a lot of money because it's such a rich archive, and I think people buy prints from him and they're serious and significant pieces of sports work. And that photographer is Brad Mangan. And if you go on his website, click on to his image archive, he's got tens of thousands of images. And he's a Canon shooter, and they're all RAW CR2 files. So he's got all of those images in, I would say, you know, museum quality archive. And the fact that he's been doing this for years, and he's got this archive that you can say, hey, I want this print that was in Sports Illustrated in 1973 on page 10. You can go straight to that image and you can buy a print that you can blow up to the size of a wall. That's where the value of RAW is. But if you can't imagine yourself doing that, then I'm with Ryu. I think having an archive in JPEG, it's a bit like photographers of the olden days, just printing everything out and having prints in filing cabinets. So you say, hey, have you got that print? Yeah, I've got that print. You go to the filing cabinet and you pull the print out. That's a bit like pulling the JPEG out. You haven't got the original, but you've got something that's pretty close and you can make a copy of the print. It's in really good condition, but the print is all you've got. So you can't really tweak it that much. You can't fix the colors as easily, but I've still got the print. What is a podcast without any shopping tips? Ryu and I will tell you what we bought recently and tell you why you need to have it now or it's going straight to the bin. So, my guess this month, Ryu, is, drumroll,
a camera bag. We all love camera bags.
Yeah, we love camera bags. So on my recent trip to New York, I didn't buy a lot of stuff. In fact, I bought very little stuff. But what I did buy was a new camera bag. And it's...
Because you needed one, right? You absolutely needed one.
In fact, I kind of did. This is a... I don't have a camera bag where I can put my laptop in and camera body or two and a couple of lenses. I've got just a really small bag that I usually just carry a laptop in. And I've also got a little little bag that I can carry a few bodies and lenses in, but I didn't have one that I could just carry one thing in. And what a lot of airlines will do is restrict you to like one piece of carry-on or two pieces of carry-on. I figure I was there and I've been wanting to get this bag for a while. So the bag I bought is made by Think Tank, and the model is called an Urban Disguise 60. And it's a great bag because it's got a sleeve in it that, or it's got a slot in it where you can put a up to a 17-inch laptop, and it can hold a bunch of stuff. Click on the link on the blog post and you'll see that at the very basic level, it'll take a body with a 70-200 attached and it just swallows it up. But what's even better is you can open a flap and you can put two extra camera bodies in it and about two other lenses. So it can swallow up as almost as much as a backpack, but it just looks like a briefcase. It's absolutely amazing bag. There's two versions. There's the Urban Disguise 60 and an Urban Disguise 50. One's just a little bit smaller than the other. The 50 can only take a 15-inch laptop. The 60 can take a 17, but it's got a really clever way of adjusting it so you can put a 15-inch in as well. And it's been great.
Think Tank, they always make good stuff, and most of the stuff that I actually have is from Think Tank. And I've never actually used the Urban Disguise series because kind of doesn't really work with what I have. In terms of actually doing a short travel, you know, with it, with your cameras and lenses and your laptop, I think it works great.
Absolutely. What do you get?
We all like straps. We talked about the Luma straps, right? The first episode probably.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've actually heard about this website called Kickstarter. I think it's only limited to United States, but what it happens is that you make up your own project and then you ask people for money. So let's say you ask for $1,000 and people put in money into your project, and depending on how much people put in, you give them away certain services or certain products you are going to be making through this project and so forth. And once the project is funded 100%, then you will start your project and you will get all the money. If the project is not funded 100%, all the money will go back to the people who actually funded it to start with. Anyway, it's by a company called Custom SLR, and they started out actually making this thing called C-Loop, which is kind of like, what was the thing that very famous camera strap?
The R-Strap.
It is kind of like the R-Strap. And C-Loop hooks on to the base of your camera, and it's got this little, you know, thing that comes out at the edge of it that you can slide through your strap. And that itself rotates 360 degrees, so the camera will rotate whichever way you actually want, but you'll be holding the camera by using the strap, so the camera actually will be upside down, but it will then rotate 360 degrees, so it'll move whichever way you want it to move. Anyway, after the C-Loop, they had this project called Split Straps. It's a strap that's got a split in the middle. You can hook up your C-Loop onto the split strap. It also has a gliding thing like the R-Strap. So the strap will be in one place, but the camera can basically go up and down the strap. And with the Luma, I realized that I had to choose one strap system because I've got two cameras. And I realized that I can actually use both of them because with the Luma, it doesn't work very well with long lenses. And vice versa for the custom SLRs, C-Loop and split straps. And I use both of them very happily. And as for the C-Loop and split straps, it does what's written on the tin. It allows you to carry the camera easier than a normal strap, I think. Costs around like together $64-$65. So if you're interested, you can go and check it out. But yeah, I think the whole strap thing is going to continue, and it's, especially for sports photography, where it's very important to be able to comfortably and effectively carry your camera because you have to react in moment's notice. This is going to be a very interesting market to look forward to in the future.
Oh my God. So I thought you were going to talk about another system that's on Kickstarter. It's called the Capture Camera Clip System.
Oh, what's that? There's another one?
Oh, that's what I thought you were going to talk about, because that's another Kickstarter project.
I have to check that one out.
This one is even more complex than the one that you've mentioned.
Is it the one that actually goes on your belt clip?
Yeah.
I've seen that before on Gizmodo or something.
This thing, they wanted to raise through Kickstarter $10,000 was the goal, so they could make the first batches. They've now raised $165,000.
It's crazy.
But it looks really good.
You have to attach that onto your belt. So your belt is going to be sagging all the time.
Sagging.
Because it's the weight of the camera onto your belt, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I've never seen the C-Loop. That looks really good. I might have to get one of those too.
Well, I hope Sid's wife is not listening to this every single time, because, yeah, he's going to go out there and buy it. The C-Loop is very good. I highly recommend it.
So it's a product now. It's finished being pledged and you can just buy it.
Yeah, you can go and buy it. We'll put up the URL on the show notes for the podcast. And yeah, you can go check it out.
And with that, we end our fourth episode of Big Lens Fast Shutter. Special thanks to Spencer Griffith for very rockin' jingles, Spotsman aka Arvin Batista for the eye-catching icons. Can't do this without them. To check out their info as well as ours, please check out biglensfastshutter.com. See you next month.